Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Welcome to the new episode of Zach on Film. This week we're not actually going to talk a movie. We're going to talk the technology behind making a movies, and what I have bought right and what I have bought wrong. This week on Zach on Film.
Hey, Zach, welcome.
Hey, Steven, I'm here.
Glad to have you here. Rodrigo's here. Yep. Matthew's here.
Yeah, I'm here.
Thought we'd take a break from movies and talk a little bit about equipment and technology and how technology has changed over time and how that's affected film production over time.
Right.
Right? Because the technology has really been able to drive a lot of the things and a lot of the techniques that we see in movies. For example, the Steadicam, right? Before, if you want to move a camera, what are the ways that you can move a camera?
Pick it up, move it.
You move it.
Okay. Or you can what?
You can dolly
it, on a trailer.
You can do a dolly, of course. You can put it on a truck.
Yeah.
If you want to do something like that. But if you want to move it up, you can put it on a jib. But if you wanted to move it up a flight of stairs, good luck. Because you're not going to lay a track and have guys push at a 45 degree angle, a 500 pound dolly up a flight of stairs. So they came up with this great concept of what would happen if we strapped a third arm onto you. What if you had a third arm and you were carrying that camera? Your body naturally counteracts things. People can see this all the time. Carry a cup of coffee up and down the stairs and you'll notice that you don't spill the coffee. Mm-hmm. Or hopefully you don't spill the coffee because your arm is counteracting your up and down movement. Well, that's what happened with the Steadicam. And of course, the Steadicam straps onto your body and the camera's hanging out there. It's all counterbalanced and smooth so that when Rocky runs up to the top of the steps and is doing his victory dance up there, you can follow him all the way up and spin around and get a really great dramatic change in the way you tell your story. Mm-hmm. And I guess as we kind of go into this, keep in mind that you're still using techniques and you're still using these things to tell your story, not to show off your stuff. But, right. You know, Steadicams, people are like, I want to own a Steadicam. I want to do these kinds of things. It's really hard to afford because they're very expensive.
They're very expensive.
So then people come up and say, well, what happens if you get rid of the vest and you just use your own arm as that gimbal and you just basically have a tripod on a stick and you do the same thing and it works, right? So we have these speed pods and we have the Merlin cams, and those work pretty good, but they tire your arm out pretty quick.
Yeah.
And they're still kind of shaky if you don't have everything balanced out right.
Although I should say that from what I understand, wearing the Steadicam rig is
it's pretty killer on your back, that's for sure. And they're dangerous as hell too. The first time somebody went into a pool, they realized, hey, if you tip over, you've got all this weight on you, you're not coming out. So they actually had to go back and redesign the Steadicam to basically have a parachute
release.
Mm-hmm. So that if you did stumble and fall, you just have to pull that and the whole thing just falls apart.
Nice.
And you can escape safely. Or if a bear's chasing you, I suppose. Right. Although that would be pretty cool.
Would be a great shot.
But now, you know, we have just shown off recently is the Movi. Have you seen this? You know what a gimbal, gimbal system is?
Yeah.
They've adapted quadcopter technology and gimbal technology for helicopters that basically as you want to
just take a little bit of time and talk about what a gimbal is.
Sure. A gimbal is,
because I don't know.
Oh, so a gimbal is anything that counteracts a movement, right? So if I tilt right, the gimbal is going to automatically correct and tilt left so that it maintains a level horizon throughout. And you've got multi-axis gimbals. You can have horizontal gimbals, vertical gimbals, Z-axis gimbals, yes. And so these are really great because it creates a super stable shot. I mean, you can move this thing all over the place, and providing that you're not going beyond the extremes edge of the
Gyros.
The gyros. This thing's going to be perfectly steady. Well, people have been putting on these on helicopters, and now that quadcopters have become very advanced, they're starting to make these mini gimbal units that you can put on the bottom of little quadcopters, like the DJI Phantom that I recently purchased. Mm-hmm. And you can get some amazing aerial shots. Well, somebody said, what if we took that gimbal technology and we put it onto a bar with handles on it, and now you just run around, and the gimbals are, you know, the gyros are keeping everything balanced, and you don't even have to worry about a Steadicam anymore, mm-hmm. because it's light, it's portable, you can hand it off to somebody else right in the middle of the shot, and it still stays very, very level. And, of course, you could have a separate operator if you want to do pans and tilts during that move. And that's, again, revolutionized the shots that people are able to do, because you can, there's a great video up on Vimeo, if you haven't seen it, where the shot starts out on the second floor, comes out onto a balcony, and then tilts down and goes down, clear down to the first floor, where they're actually lowering it down on a rope.
Wow.
Guys down at the bottom grab it and continue on with the shot, and it just is one flowing motion all the way around. Very, very cool. Problem is, it's like $15,000 for this thing, right? Yeah. But the other thing that we notice with technology as it changes is that not only does it get smaller and it'll adapt, but people will find ways of making it cheaper. And there's a kid on Kickstarter right now who's got one for like $3,000 that he's basically been configuring himself for 2 years and now has got everything machined out and is willing to sell these parts. $3,000 for the exact same thing.
Wow.
So we've gone over this time span of being moving a 500-pound camera on a track or a truck to moving a 20-pound, 30-pound camera on a Steadicam to taking 5- to 7-pound cameras and being able to move them anywhere, anytime, and pulling off dramatic shots for your piece. So I think when we talk about technology and kind of the things that I kind of wanted us to talk about today is how the technology has changed over time. When Matthew and I were young, when we were kids, when we were in college, when we were your age, Zach.
Hey, Zach.
Yes?
When Steven and I used to shoot, we were actually told to keep a dime in your pocket at all times. Do you know why that is, Steven?
Take off the base.
Well, Steven, I know why that is.
Zach, do you know why that is?
Take off the base plate of your tripod.
Well, that's one thing. That's more one. Of a quarter or a nickel, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you'll want a quarter.
We used to shoot on something called 3/4-inch tape.
Mm-hmm. U-matic, baby.
U-matic, yeah. Luckily, we did not have to live in the era of 1-inch or quad.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, God.
But you know how on, well, maybe you don't know, because I know many of my students didn't know that there's a record tab on their mini DV tapes. Mm. Record tab, you know, you pop that little record tab and it prevents you from recording on the tape. Well, on the 3/4 U-matic tapes, on the bottom of the on the tape, there was a little red tab that you would literally pull out. It was like a little button that you would pull out and you put in your pocket and you do whatever. Well, these were notoriously easy to lose.
Yeah.
And so the interesting thing was a dime was the exact same size as this button. So you take a dime, take a piece of tape, tape it onto your bottom of your U-matic, pop it in your cassette player, and away you go.
You can record over what's on that tape.
So, yes, we always had to carry a dime and a quarter. A quarter in case you had to make a phone call to somebody.
Yeah.
Still good advice today. Back then, we had telephones that were not mobile.
What?
Seems weird.
I know. Back then. We also, you know, when we talk about cameras and size, Matthew and I used to shoot 3/4-inch, but we would shoot on these big tube cameras. And in order to, and these were not cameras that were a single unit. We actually had an umbilical cord that went from our camera down to a record deck that we wear, that we wore. Is probably about the size of your backpack that housed the
maybe a little bigger
machine.
Yep, and that actually housed the recorder.
When you count in, when you counted in the batteries, when you counted in the deck, when you counted in the weight of the camera, you were easily carrying,
I'd say
50 to 65 pounds around.
Yep. Honestly, sounds horrible.
Yes, but here's the nice thing about a heavy camera. Here's the really nice thing about a heavy camera. You put a heavy camera on your shoulder, that thing's a rock steady shot.
Mm. Oh yeah,
because all that weight is just down on you, and so things weren't moving around. But there are drawbacks to that. The very first job I had after college when I was in Atlanta, I was shooting a car show with one of these systems. And a car show usually happens in the summertime, right?
Yeah.
Car show is going to need a lot of space when you have 300 to 500 cars there. So you're probably going to hold it in a giant parking lot. They did this at a mall. Asphalt. Heavy gear. First summer in Atlanta.
Did you go
also
down?
Happened to be the hottest day on record of the year. Something like 105.
Down,
no, I didn't. I came really close.
Oh,
I heat doesn't really get to me, but that day I was just pouring sweat. I mean, you could wring it out of me. But a lot of it was because I'm hefting this camera, umbilical cord deck, and tripod around trying to get all these shots of these cars. So I guess one of the nice things, Rodrigo, one of the nice things that happens was the introduction of the mini DV technology.
Yep.
And that happened in the, I want to say like 94, 95 is when it was being tested. I remember seeing the first mini DV demos at a meeting that Sony put on.
Yeah.
And everybody in the room was like, oh, this will never be any good quality. But that revolutionized how people approach film.
Yeah.
And filmmaking.
Yeah. In fact, that's mostly what I used when I was in school. Is we actually used a lot of DVC Pro and Mini DV, just depending on what camera you were able to check out.
Right.
These are digital formats. So not only that, but when even just for video, when the big HD switchover happened or started to happen, they found, or maybe this was functionality that, you know, Sony had always mystically put into the DV tape, like the exact same DV tapes could just be coded into HD.
Right.
So there was no need for a major format change either for pro, basically pro and consumer cameras.
Yeah. The other thing that's nice about a switch over to digital that you may appreciate, Zach, is that in a digital format, you can make as many copies as you want, and the 100th copy is going to look as good as the first copy.
Yeah.
Back in three-quarter days with Matthew and I, if you made a copy, you were probably okay for the first generation copy. But if you made another copy out of that, you would start to see significant
dropout
on your image. So if you were doing an A-B edit, and an A-B edit is essentially today a wipe, a dissolve, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You had two different decks, your original footage on two different decks, running through an edit system, doing your dissolve or whatever, your switcher, onto a second tape. So already just to get to your master in any edit was one generation down. If you made copies of your master, you're probably okay, but anything after that started to look muddy and terrible. Digital really changed that.
Yep.
It also, because of the mini DV format, meant your cameras could be smaller and lighter, and you didn't have to worry about tubes. You could work with chips and three chips and various size chips. And cameras became super light and portable, and they became super inexpensive.
Yeah.
And I think what we've talked about before, and I know that we've talked about, maybe not on this show, but we've talked about the barrier to entry. What's the barrier to entry, Zach? Do you know what that is?
The obstacles you have to get over to actually do what you want to do.
And so the biggest one for most filmmakers is the price.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're shooting on film, I think, Rodrigo, we kind of talked after show last time about, did you shoot something on film when you were in school?
Oh, I did, yeah.
Was it on 8mm, 16mm, 35? What did you shoot on? Do you remember?
I want to say it was 8.
8mm, just a little cartridge?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what we shot on too, but you know, even then it was hard to find. And we had to order away for it. And so it would take a couple of weeks for the film to get in.
And then we had to have it processed.
And you know, in film, you don't get to see the picture before it's developed. So you don't know if you even got something until weeks afterwards. Now, of course, in real film industry, you've got dailies, which they're processed overnight and you can watch the next day. But that was terribly expensive. I mean, $20 for a college student in the 80s and 90s was terribly expensive. Just to get the raw 8mm film footage, let alone the processing cost for it.
Plus, you know, the complete and absolutely possible eventuality that at some point you accidentally expose your film to sunlight, either loading it or unloading it.
And if you're looking at 35mm film, I mean, the numbers that I was quoting back in the 90s was about $100 per 10 minutes. So if you had a two-hour movie... you know, 120 mm-hmm. minutes, there's $12,000, right? Or I'm sorry, $100 for 10 minutes. Yeah. So yeah. that would be
$10 a minute.
Yeah. $10 a minute.
$1,200.
Yeah. So $1,200. And that's just for your final.
That's just, yeah, final. That's
if you had a, if stock. You had a 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 5-to-1 shooting ratio for those who don't know is the ratio of material shot to the ratio of material finally used.
Right.
You could be looking at $5,000-$10,000 easily. I remember when I was accepted to USC, and they were like, "Oh yeah, your projects you can expect to spend about $30,000 per project." And I was like, "Oh, you got to be kidding me! I'm going to go to school that's not going to cost me an arm and a leg." But that's how much they were mm-hmm. expecting you to go in cost on that. So it's incredibly expensive to get into it if you were going to do anything on film, and even if you were going to do anything on video. $15,000 is not uncommon for a good lens. Even today, a good HD lens, a good broadcast lens yeah. might be $20,000, $30,000 just for the lens. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we can get mini DV, we can get consumer cameras like the Sony cameras, the Sony PD150 was, or the VX1000 was really the first consumer DV camera that made it possible for indie filmmakers to go off and spend $5,000 on a camera, $10 on tape, and shoot to their heart's content. Mm. And they could look at it. That was a big game changer for filmmakers. I mean, did you guys do a lot of stuff on DV then when you were finishing up film school?
Yeah. I mean, anything, basically almost any student project, any like extracurricular or student run project was almost exclusively on DV, except for the guys who absolutely wanted to shoot on film, and they went to film school to shoot on film, gish, darn it,
yeah.
they were going to do it. But, I mean, we had cameras that already had, I mean, you could change the
frame rate.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, it's not just that you could change the frame rate, but it could also, you could always add some amount of grain in
sure,
post. So
sure.
it was like,
yeah,
you could simulate a film.
Yeah, to the untrained eye, and I mean, even to the trained eye, if you weren't, you know, really like analyzing mm-hmm. it, like, you know, by like stopping it and seeing that there is some amount of interlacing
right.
here and there, like, it absolutely looked like film. There was no reason for us not to shoot it on video, and we're talking about like $10 a tape.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Literally. I mean,
you know,
or
and
less.
It's like, yeah, and it's like a 90-minute tape is mm-hmm. $10 mm-hmm. or less.
Here's the cool thing. Shortly after the Sony VX1000 came out, Canon came out with their camera, the XL1. Mm-hmm. And the XL1 really looked like a film camera. The way that it was set up, the way that it was angled, it looked like a little 16mm camera ready to have a 16mm mag slapped on the back so you could go and shoot stuff. This thing would have the variable frame rate. It had, it just mm-hmm. looked beautiful. I lusted after that camera for years. I mean, I was just always, I mean, we got
that
a couple
camera
in,
never returned my calls.
When it was right before I left Atlanta that the school I was teaching at got a bunch of them, like literally a month before I left. So I never got a chance to use the cameras except for just getting them set up. And then I moved. But these were awesome cameras. So awesome, in fact, that, again, filmmakers could go out and shoot something that looked like it was shot on film and do it fast and do it cheap and do some amazing things with it, to the point that we have a director who goes out and shoots a zombie movie in the streets of London mm-hmm. with, I believe it was the Canon XL1, maybe mm-hmm. the XL2, 28 days later, was shot on a video camera, passed off as film, and people today even watch it and think that it's film.
Yeah, and I know it. I don't remember what I was watching, but they brought up that in his choice of cameras, and he said the only way that movie could have been made is if they were shooting it on the XL1s, because some of those scenes they just ran multiple cameras and they shot a bunch of, because they had to get multiple angles.
Oh, yeah,
they didn't have the permissions to shut down the roads all the time, so they had to be able to shoot fast, and they couldn't afford four different film cameras, but they could buy a couple XL1s and slap some tapes in there.
Well, wasn't the Phantom Menace actually shot?
Oh yeah, now that was shot not on an inexpensive digital camera, but Lucas for a long time has always been interested in digital and manipulating mm-hmm. the image digitally. And a lot of our listeners also know this, that the pros and cons of that. But he made the choice of shooting everything, I believe it was on the Cine Alta,
mm-hmm.
With the Star Wars Episode One, because he said it gave him so much more freedom. And this was really probably, I don't want to say the first major motion picture, because I mean, 28 Days Later kind of did it first.
Yeah.
But really it was the first major studio film that would have been done digitally with no film at all.
Yeah. And then it was the first film projected digitally in theaters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Lucas is just all over digital.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's some pros and cons of digital. Digital doesn't have nearly the contrast range that an analog film would have. Certainly that's changed more recently with the advent of shooting in HDR,
mm-hmm.
The high dynamic range. It often video is sharper than film,
mm-hmm.
and that's why people who went and saw The Hobbit at the higher frame rate were saying, oh, this looks too much like a soap opera.
Right.
It doesn't look like film. Well, video tends to be sharper and running at a faster frame rate than film, 30 frames per second, or in the case of The Hobbit, 48 frames a second.
Right.
So it does look more realistic and sharp and crisp.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the grain, the organicness of the grain, because the grain in film is a chemical process, not an electronic process. So yeah, you lose a lot of stuff when you go from film to digital.
Right.
Today, when we look at it, I don't want to say a majority of films are shot digitally.
Oh, really? Because I would.
But it's pretty close.
I would say a goodly portion.
I think the amount of films that are shot exclusively on film are small. I think there's a hybrid. A lot of people will shoot digital and film.
Right.
And then people will shoot all digital.
There's a list over on Wikipedia. I don't know how up-to-date it is, but it's got a list of films shot digitally. And when you look at it, goes all the way back to 98, and it starts to go forward. And you jump through the years pretty quickly until you hit about 2012. And then, of course, that just scrolls on and on and on. It's about four or five page downs that you have to hit to get through all the films in 2012 that were shot digitally. Act of Valor. By Shane Hurlbut. That one I want to come back and talk about a little bit because of the Canon 5D Mark II.
When they emigrated, they changed that name from Heave Tookus, by the way.
You've got, what's another one that's the Avatar movie, all digital.
Mm-hmm.
Iron Man 3, all digital. And a lot more that people would know. But there's also a number of movies that are shot, Hobbit, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There's still, though, a lot of filmmakers that prefer the film process because it has that feel of something more epic.
And there are people that will never, they will shoot on film as long as they possibly can.
Give me an example of somebody who will shoot on film as long as they possibly can.
Nolan says he will shoot on film for as long as he is, he can still buy film.
Right. Yeah, Christopher Nolan is one. Argo was shot on film.
Yeah.
And what's
Ryan
really interesting.
Johnson shot Looper on film.
Oh, yeah. If you watch Argo, I almost want to say that it almost feels like they went back and got film stock the 1970s because it has that look to it that feels like that you're embedded in that time period. Of course, as you said, Christopher Nolan only wants to do stuff on film. Zack Snyder did 300. That was his big breaker digitally. But when it came to Man of Steel, he went and flipped that over to film because he said it gave it more of an epic feel to it. I also wonder if maybe Christopher Nolan's Spectre kind of had an influence.
There is definitely a Nolan influence. That definitely could have been one.
Yeah, there was definitely a Nolan influence in the Man of Steel.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see specifically. It doesn't list Star Wars on here. It doesn't go back that far.
Star Wars was not shot digitally.
Well, episode 1, maybe it is on here. Let me see here.
Okay.
Star Wars episode 1 was shot digitally. We were just talking about that. The three big cameras that people are using now, or at least I should say independent filmmakers, because when we get up into the studios, I mean, they're still shooting with the Cine Altas and the Aeroflexes and a lot of people today are shooting on the Red camera, and the Red is designed by the Oakley sunglasses guy. That's the guy who owns Red, same guy that made your backpack there, by the way, Zach.
Yep.
What's his name?
Oakley Von Schnicken.
Oh, hold on just a second.
Annie Oakley.
Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein. No.
That's actually his species. He's an Oakley. They come from Oakland.
I can find it here in a minute. But,
I'm proud to be an Oakley from...
So people are shooting on the Red One, which is a great camera, and everybody's scrambling for that.
Yeah.
Red One.
But a lot of people are shooting on cameras like the 5D Mark II and the more recent 5D Mark III, the Blackmagic Design Camera, which just came out. A lot of cameras.
Yeah, when you get down into the lower indie, I think you'll see a lot of... can stuff, but I mean bigger movies are shooting like B cameras on Mark IIs.
A friend of mine that I went to high school with was a gaffer on 24, and he had told me that there's a lot of times that they would take the 5D Mark IIs and just attach them to the camera cars, and that's what they were shooting all their exterior stuff with. They drive around with these cameras strapped all over the car to get their shots. This is great, small camera.
Yeah.
What are some advantages of a digital SLR? SLR standing for single lens reflex, meaning that it's like a traditional 35mm camera where you've got a mirror that has to flip up in order to expose the film, or in this case, expose the chip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are some advantages of a camera like the 5D Mark II or III? What do you have?
I have a Canon 60D.
Oh, 60D. Okay, so
yeah.
is that a crop sensor camera?
It is.
Okay, so what does that mean? Crop sensor camera.
It means that you're not getting the full image, but it's cropping the 35mm down.
Right. To something smaller. And it's whatever that multiplier is. 0.6, I think, is probably what it is. So the biggest disadvantage is you're losing some of your area to expose your image on. Right. This is the problem with the early digital cameras, is you're shooting on 1/8-inch chips or 2/3-inch chips, really small chips to get an image on. Whereas if you could shoot something that's on a large 35mm sensor, you get that shallow depth of field. You can open up your aperture even bigger to get the shallow depth of field and get more light exposure and so on and so on. The other thing that's kind of problematic for a crop sensor camera is figuring out your lenses.
Yeah.
Because a 50mm lens, as we talked in one of the previous episodes, is what would be a normal lens. But on a crop sensor, you take that multiplier like 0.6, whatever that may be. You take that times 50, and that's the equivalent of what you're getting with that camera. So you're actually getting more a closer shot with that. But what are some advantages that you see of a digital SLR compared to like the PD-150s or the PD-170s that that you used in college?
Yeah, depth of field is one of the main factors of shooting with my 60D over the cameras I shot with college that I really like. I think there's just a greater range of, you can get just so much shallower depth of field with the DSLRs. Image quality, obviously, over what we shot on college, because what we were shooting on college wasn't an HD.
Right.
We were shooting an FG, so that's really not a fair comparison. But I enjoy shooting on digital cards over mini DVs immensely.
Why?
Just the portability and ease of extraction of what I just shot is so much easier than having to rip off a tape.
Now, Rodrigo, at PBS, you guys made that migration from SD to HD, right? Mm-hmm. And you guys went through a technology change as well. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, we went to... Canon's, I actually don't remember what the model number is on those, but we actually got the cameras that we got. We specifically got prosumer models instead of pro models because they had image stabilization. And like a lot of the time when we're out shooting, Kansas is so windy that we actually need image stabilization.
You
know, like it's a thing for people who are like shooting off the shoulder, and they don't, supposedly it's something that pros don't need, right? Because you're going to have all these things. But seriously, sometimes when you're doing a long zoom or something like that out here, the image stabilization actually helps.
But again, it's also the equivalent of dealing with, as Matthew and I were talking about earlier, a 60-pound camera versus a 10-pound camera or a 5-pound camera.
I don't know if it's so much that a pro wouldn't need it. I think part of it is a pro wouldn't want it.
First of all,
because I know that there were quite a few features on the and we when I was last in television, we bought consumer cameras because they were the cheapest.
Right.
There were a lot of features that I literally had to go through and turn off.
Sure, sure.
Because the camera was doing so much to try and fix what I wanted to do when I was actually shooting with the bloody thing. So I would definitely say that that's an issue.
We have obviously at PBS, we have at least the PBS station that I work at. We have money issues. We got cameras that can shoot both, that specifically could shoot both in HD and SD, because some of our equipment only works in SD.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
We didn't have the money to overhaul everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, our control room, our control panel, only our switcher basically only works in SD.
Mm.
So if we wanted stuff that was compatible with that, our field cameras had to be in SD as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after that, we can like up convert it because we do have an HD channel
right. That
everything goes on. But yeah, right now, it's funny because like half the things that we do are in SD. Like anything we shoot in the studio has to be in SD. Anything we shoot out on the field, we've basically completely switched over to doing it in HD.
But you're not using a digital SLR. You're still using a traditional video camera, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And have you shot with a digital SLR?
No.
Okay. So you wouldn't have a means of comparison?
Not really, no.
Okay. But you've been around when I've shot stuff on my digital SLR. And,
right.
And you've seen some stuff.
And then I like reach for it and you're like, no.
Actually, I've got a couple of cameras. One's actually.
Yeah, actually, did you see the cameras at Nurtacular?
Yes.
Those are exactly the same cameras that we use.
Oh, okay. All right. So those are Panasonics or something?
They're Canons.
Oh, are they? Okay. I didn't see. I know that they had a couple Black Magics or at least one Black Magic design.
They did. That's something else, though.
Yeah. Okay. So Zach is all hot and bothered over the Black Magic design.
It looks nice.
Did you see from a interactive systems design standpoint what's wrong with that camera?
No, I never actually looked at the interface. I just looked at the body of it.
But did you see how the people were shooting?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's Zach for you. Then look at the face.
No, they were not.
Checking out the body.
No, right. They were not. The problem with the Blackmagic design is the back is your
right.
Your screen.
Your viewfinder.
Is putting that on your viewfinder. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to shoulder mount that, how are you going to shoulder mount that?
Oddly.
So, yes. So, if you can imagine drawing a straight line off your right shoulder about, 8 inches
mm-hmm.
from your shoulder, maybe a foot, that's where that screen is. If you're really wanting to see something, did you see how those guys were?
Oh, yeah.
They were craning their necks trying to get in so that they could see what's going on that viewfinder, to the point where I can't imagine that they were walking away without sore necks at the end of the day.
They needed a double shoulder mount.
Well, or they needed something that shifted that over to the left,
yeah.
Or a different viewfinder altogether.
Oh, right.
But from an ergonomic standpoint, no way would you catch me using that camera.
Potentially, they could like fit it with some kind of bypass where they would have an eyepiece.
Yeah, I'm sure that Blackmagic AJA has that.
When you look at people shooting it for film and you have it on a tripod, it's completely fine at that point.
Sure, if that's how you're doing it. But
right,
what they were doing it, no thanks.
No.
Plus, there's a number of other issues with that camera as well.
It's the idea of shooting 2K, 4K at a
2K. So let's make this clear. When people say 2K, we're essentially talking 1080p, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly bigger. But
yeah, that's totally clear.
Not by much.
Not
by much. Okay, 1920, you're looking at a difference of 80 pixels.
Right.
Okay, so when people are like, oh, this can shoot in 2K. Yes, well, HD 1080
it's close.
Is equivalent. 4K, that's cool, but how's that HD going for you guys over there? You're still having to down convert a bunch of your HD stuff when you're editing?
No,
to
actually,
make it compatible?
No, actually, we do it. We edit in HD.
But then do you down convert it so it plays on your SD channel?
Yeah. We just take everything. We basically up-convert everything that's SD to our HD channel, and we down-convert anything that's SD to our that's HD to our SD channel.
I mean, it's I think it's great that people are talking about 4K now, and that people are advancing.
So what you're saying is like there's no like anything that you shoot in 4K, you're going to have to downconvert right now.
Yeah, you're going to have to. And I mean, I don't even know how far you have to go with like a 70 millimeter, what the equivalency is there, you know, 70 millimeter film. But I mean, and this is the question that's going on right now in our building is everyone's like, so do we want to go ahead and get 4K cameras? And I'm like, no, because we're not doing anything in 4K. Everything will have to be down converted into an HD signal, or we're going to be shooting everything in 720 or 1080 to be sent out over our cable system and our various outlets.
Right.
At this point, it doesn't make fiscal sense for us to be investing money in 4K equipment, because in 10 years, when it finally becomes commonplace that every TV and every channel is broadcasting in 4K, it'll also be cheaper for us to do that too.
For what you're doing, it doesn't, it's not as practical, but
well, Mr. Snooty
cinema,
filmmaker over there. What
no,
are you doing
I'm not
for?
Doing it.
Let,
but
let
I read things
before you shoot
where
him down.
That directors like shooting in 4K.
Oh, sure.
Because they have the ability to stabilize their shot if they want or get the exact framing that they want.
I'll tell you what, it is nice. Back when we got our HD cameras but we were doing everything in SD. To be able to shoot wide and then basically digitally zoom in to what we wanted. It still looked fine because we were it got down converted to SD. So I could shoot an interview without touching the camera. I didn't have to zoom in and out. Just have the guy with a big white thing around his head of empty space. And I could zoom into his face, zoom out of his face, frame into the left, to the right.
Here's a hint. A lot of internet video that you're seeing right now that's in 720. They're shooting it at 1080 and doing the exact same thing. We do that. I've done that a lot, too.
Yeah.
In fact, we shot Want List a lot at 1080, and then we edit it down in 720 so that we have the ability to pop in for a close-up and pop out. So it works really great.
Yep.
And so from that perspective, yes, that is a nice thing for a filmmaker to be able to shoot in 4K and be able to do those things, or even be able to make a really high-quality print off of that if they're still going into a film distribution, or if they're going into digital theater and projecting, it works great there. Let me ask you this, young Zach.
Sure.
What are the chances you, as you become a filmmaker and you start going out there and making your movies? I think, do we need to get rid of the word film? Do we need to get rid of that as a term?
I don't think so. I mean, I can see people being like, oh, you should just call them movies. I guess you could, if you switch to movies, it would be fine. But I don't have a problem with calling them films.
People what about, still call CDs albums.
Do you have a problem with someone going out and saying, Rodrigo, go out and film film that rodeo?
No, I don't, because otherwise there's only a couple other things that they can say, one of which is shoot. And that, like, especially around here, where lots of people own guns, that just sounds weird to people. It's like, oh, I'm just going to go there and shoot the rodeo.
So this is, so film is just going to become a generic term for anything of capturing.
I think it already has. And I understand the, like, for example, mostly the engineer. It's interesting. The engineers kind of seem to care about this. Us production guys don't. When we write our scripts, or rather when other people write the scripts, like for Pledge, for example, they will have a break in there and it'll say tape.
Right,
because it's always said tape. And it's like the engineers are like, actually, we're running them, either we're running them digitally or we have this like blue violet disc system. And they're like, so they're technically not tapes. And it's like, just let them put tape down. It doesn't matter. When you want to get technical, when you're actually having a technical discussion, you can talk about the difference between filming something and shooting something on video. But when you're talking about, hey, are you going to see, I don't know, Life of Pi or whatever, I don't think it matters whether you call them films or movies or whatever.
Matthew, what were you going to say?
I guess it falls to the same point that when I get in the Chrysler, I am not forcing the cattle to run to market. But I am still driving, and I think that, you know, even though that phrase comes from a specific place and has a specific meaning, I don't necessarily know that saying I'm going to go see a film and that being shot entirely on digital.
You mean you guys don't say, I'm going to navigate my automobile to the cinema
I'm going
and
to navigate
watch
my...
a motion picture? No.
But first...
No. That's what I tell. That's what I say.
I will pick up my young lady friend and then escort her to the picture show.
Well, you're not really going to pick her up.
No.
Right, you're going to escort
money
her
right,
to the
right.
movie show.
Right, right exactly. Funny,
so, Zach, but... when you become a movie maker...
No, I will actually... To get her into the car, I
oh,
actually
you will
lift,
lift
her.
Oh, okay.
And
Rodrigo
put her in
has
the seat.
A sick lift system on his
the
car.
The giant
on his Yaris, yes.
Wooden wheels.
Yes,
Yaris actually has huge hydraulics.
It's, yeah. it's half Yaris, half Studebaker.
Yeah. So when you become a movie maker, Zach, and you make your first picture show, mm-hmm. where's this going to be exhibited? Where are you going to show it?
On the side of the
bar.
I mean,
we're talking about my first one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it'll probably be on, like, YouTube.
You say that so pejoratively.
No. Well, kind of YouTube.
Why do you treat that as a bad thing? Why is YouTube a bad thing for distribution?
It's not a bad thing. It's just there is a whole lot of muck in YouTube.
Oh, sure.
That to get over that in any shape or form is quite difficult. I mean, when you go to the front page of YouTube and... The first three video clips are a news reporter pronouncing someone's name wrong, because that's funny. Then you have nothing that's actually, like, creative. It's just like, oh, look, she said something live on TV. Let's just capture it and put it on YouTube, and it has 15 million hits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an issue with YouTube. But it's fine. I mean, YouTube is great for what it is. And it can be YouTube is able to be many different things. One of them is for funny cats. One of them is for weird talking oranges. Another one is for people to like put content of shows and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So what's wrong? Do you think that your movie has to go to the movie house, to the movie theater?
I think it'd be
to the
cool.
big screen.
I think it'd be cool, but it's not necessary.
Is it necessary or is it not necessary?
Well, I mean, depends. What you want to do? Do you want to make a lot of money? Then yeah, it's got to go.
Well,
almost.
I mean, I guess first off, what do you want? I mean, is this the are we talking about the movie that he's working on right now?
No.
Some future
2-hour. You know,
gotcha.
Walking across the plains of Kansas to slay a dragon on the other end.
When right. he goes out to reboot Clash of the Titans in 2022,
make sure right. you have a really good Kraken.
No, you need to reboot the black hole.
Okay.
I will voice one of those robots for you.
Thank you.
It'd be Maximilian.
I've never seen it.
Maximilian doesn't speak. Oh.
Floated right into that one.
Most people don't realize that Steven is his middle name and his first name is Aristotle, which makes his initials actually ass.
So
Well, what do you want? I mean, do you want to make a movie that is seen in a theater, or do you want a movie that is widely distributed through the internet?
Second one.
Okay.
So then it doesn't matter if you...
Then you want to end up on YouTube.
Yeah. Or Vimeo or wherever they're distributed.
It's probably all of them.
It's, I think...
Yes.
To get to a theater distribution on... Like, I mean, we're talking theater distribution. I'm talking like wide release.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, even if it's in America, wide release.
Well, wait a minute. The internet, you know, is the widest release that we have.
No, I'm talking theater wide release.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so much money.
It's a lot of money.
It's unbelievable.
And certainly, you know, going back to digital, we don't have to make, I was listening to an interview with Adam Carolla and he was talking about The Hammer. It's a great film if people haven't seen it. It didn't get a wide distribution because it was like $15,000 per print to get out to the theaters. And he had to go into his own pocket something like $100,000. That's 100 prints. That's 100 theaters that you can show it in. There's only like 3,700 movie theaters in the United States. Somebody want to look that up real quick? I'm pretty sure that... there's less than that.
Siri, how many movie theaters are in the United States?
There are 307. Shut up.
If there are 307.
I'm Siri now.
Here we go. Number of U.S. movie screens in the year 2011, there were 38,000 screens for indoor, 606 drive-in. Now, 38,000 divided by your multiplexes, there's probably not that many theaters.
Even if you figure that, you know, if Plexus with only two or three screens, you're probably not going to get 5,000 theaters.
Yeah, five. Yeah. Somebody will look this up and write in. So digital distribution obviously is cheaper because they're just sending it over the they're sending the hard drive and you just pop it in and you play it and go.
Well, now they're even just doing
through the internet.
Through they download it from satellites. They give them unlock codes and then just
from satellites.
Yeah, in fact, there's a really cool thing.
Yeah.
For what was it? Iron Man or no, Avengers. For projectionists, they send out this thing saying, "Make sure that when you download this, that when you run it the first time, go through all these checks to make sure that the file is correct, to make sure it's balanced correctly, da, da, da." But 5,000 theaters, 38,000 screens, you want what? 5,000 of those screens, 8,000 of those screens? Is that what you want?
Well, me?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, hypothetically, I mean, you'd want to, you can't really do all of them because then nothing else would be showing in America.
But, yes, that is what I want from my movie.
I mean, really, that's exactly what you would want because everyone just has to buy a ticket to your movie.
I would,
but
say
I don't know. It's not.
Realistic.
It's not a thing that
for a wide release.
So I have never thought about because it's just been since I've been in this making mentality. It's everything just goes on the internet because that's. I mean, that's what we do now. It's easier.
Sure. Just for comparison, Wolverine, The Wolverine, the sequel, opened in 3,900 theaters in the United States.
3,900 theaters?
3,900 theaters.
Every now, time you say The Wolverine, you sound like my grandma.
Well, that's what it's the title of the movie.
That's what the movie is. It's The Wolverine.
We're going to go down to the movie theater, and we're going to watch The Star Wars.
No, the name of this movie is The Wolverine.
The
Wolverine.
So... that's what you're looking at. You're looking at around 4,000 screens for a wide release.
Yeah.
Snicked bub.
I think that's still a great goal to try to go for.
Yeah.
Certainly you can't win Academy Awards. You can't help people get Screen Actor Guild Awards unless it's been shown in a traditional theater at least once.
Yeah.
Right. Just like you can't win an Emmy unless you're, production has been shown on television somewhere, right?
Is that true?
That is true.
But what about Netflix?
Netflix isn't a movie theater.
They got nominated.
For what?
For an Emmy.
For Screen Actors Guild, right?
For an Emmy. Really? For an Emmy. Yeah, okay. House of Cards got nominated.
Oh, okay. It didn't air on another television show?
Not on Showtime or anything?
No, it's okay. The...
Because people were making a big deal about this on the internet. Thing.
Cool. I think... personally, people today are better off distributing through internet outlets than through trying to go through a movie theater route. I think you have the potential to make more money. I think you have a potential to make a bigger name for yourself. I think you have the potential to get your project seen by more people than you would if you went to the traditional theater route. Am I wrong on that, Rodrigo?
Do
you have some thoughts on that?
Well, the only thing that counters that, I think, is that there's already a system for people to go to the theater and watch movies. Now, you can say that there's a system for people to download things from the internet, but in the internet, there's a trillion things to see.
Right.
When you want to go to the movies, there are four or five things to see.
Mm-hmm.
So... in that sense, yes. But from the standpoint of I want to get my movie out to people, it's going to be a lot, like you said, it's going to be a lot cheaper to do it through the internet. And doing it through the theaters, there's going to be just so many hoops that you have to jump through. And to, in the end, potentially have individual theaters decide not to run it.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the whole marketing aspect that you have to go through, too.
Yeah.
But you'd have to do that either way because you know, on the internet, you want people, you have to get the message out there because, again, there's six gazillion things that anybody could watch instead of your movie.
But price wise,
I would argue that it's cheaper to market for something online than it is to market for a movie.
I can see that, sure.
And unless you're, what's his name? Tyler Perry, and the way he markets movies, I don't think you're going to get. I think it's going to be hard to do that. I'm not going to say it's impossible.
Does he just show up at people's houses?
Well, originally he would go to the churches and say, hey, everybody, watch this film. get behind this. This is a good movie for you to watch and go see it. And so the churches would all start showing them locally in the churches, and then it started getting bigger. And, you know, Tyler Perry now owns a huge studio in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I don't remember if that burned just recently or had a fire recently near it.
That's actually like a wonderful strategy to market a movie.
It worked for him. It worked for him. It
has to be the right kind
of movie.
If
you have the right
though.
Movie and you get church people behind it, it'll make a piss ton of money.
Or you could also make a church movie that pisses off a lot of church people.
Oh, yeah.
And then you're in trouble that way. I don't know if Last Temptation, it did pretty good for itself, right?
I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, Zach, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with this gear that you've purchased? Are you going to make it for yourself? Are you going to make it for a local audience? Are you going to go for a wide audience? What's your ultimate goal?
Make money so I can pay off the loan I took out to buy all of it. That's my immediate goal.
Sure, pay off your...
Yeah.
Okay, do you have a long-term vision of what you want to do with this? I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. Yeah. A lot of people get into this kind of stuff... internet filmmaking for a lot of reasons. They do it for money, as you already mentioned. They do it for celebrity. You know, they want to be internet famous, or they want to be famous just from that. Could be ego driven. It could be doing it for quality of life issues. You know,
yeah.
I do stuff when I want. Do it once a month. Put it up online.
Yeah.
You look at Devin Supertramp, his stuff. You'd know it if you saw it. It's the guy that jumps off the canyons and records everything as people are going down and that kind of stuff. He did this really cool parkour thing for San Diego Comic-Con that I think comes out this week or next week.
Cool.
But basically people are paying his way to go to all these different places in the world and shoot this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, it seems like a quality of life issue, although probably making some good money off of it, but I think it's for him. It's, hey, I want to travel. I want to do these things now and work with all these great people. And so he's able to do that. So what's your ultimate end goal? Quality of life, ego, money, celeb?
Certainly not ego and not celebrity.
Rodrigo's pointing to himself. Do it for me. You're doing it all for me.
Do it for my ego.
Yeah. Make us famous, you jerk.
I mean, it sounds hokey, but I want to do it just because I love doing it. Like,
that's
I've
not
always
hokey.
I mean, but that's just
dude,
like
it's
that.
Super hokey.
Yeah, no, it totally is. It totally is.
Why do you do it, Rodrigo?
Money.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Actually, the main reason why I'm in video production is because I'm good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I do like expressing myself through video, but that's not what I'm doing right now because I'm working for someone else doing stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's primarily because it's something I'm good at and something that they'll pay me to do.
What about you, Matthew? I mean, you don't work in video specifically, but why do you do the podcast and why do you do the website? What are you hoping to get out of it?
I'm a Sagittarius, and a Sagittarius loves it when people go, hey, ain't he cute, ain't he clever. So I think for me, it's probably about, you know, that celebrity validation bit.
Mm.
Not necessarily people saying, oh gosh, he's wonderful and blah, blah, blah. But to occasionally, you know, that moment where you throw out a joke and 300 episodes of the podcast later, somebody goes, I got that joke. And I'm like, good, it was just for you. That ability, you know, to go do, 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 and have somebody go, hey, that was kind of cool.
I think for me, I do a lot of this not to make money, although ultimately what I want to do is to be able to do a lot of the stuff that we're doing for quality of life change, right?
Yeah.
So that we can work on projects that we want to work on, so that we can explore things that we want to work on. But right now I'm doing it because I love to create stuff, right? I mean, it's just like, what can we create next to get people to watch or listen or be a part of and get involved with? And is there a way to transform that into a different quality of life? Right now, it's not a great quality of life because we're up at right now 1 o'clock in the morning recording episodes and then editing them together and putting them out for people. And then we all get up and go do RWJs. And for people that don't know what I refer to on Twitter as an RWJ, a real world job, we go and do that from 7:30 in the morning until 5 at night and then come back and do all this stuff again.
If we're lucky.
I would love to be able to do this as the full time, just create, 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 because part of it is the learning experience that goes on from creation. You know, you learn from mistakes. You can push things boundaries. You can see what other people are doing and adapt it to what you're doing. And I think it's that creation process and the distribution and seeing the joy or reading about the joy that people get from the artwork that is the – and I don't think that's ego-driven. I don't think that's quality of life-driven. No. It's just like I like creating stuff for you to enjoy.
It's expression. It's self-expression.
Yeah. So yeah. I think that's what I get out of it.
It's not precisely ego, but it has some similar roots beneath it.
Sure. Probably. Yeah. So again, Zach, what do you want to get out of all of this? If it's money, money's easy to come by, yeah. right? I can give you a car to somebody right now who you can fly up to Vancouver and do a bunch of videos for that person. And it's money.
Cool.
It's money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can get into, I mean, just look and see what people are doing for money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for better or worse, porn industry is all about money, right? Mm-hmm. And do you want to go down that low? Do you want to go up? I mean, so what do you want to get out of this?
I know it's definitely not money. I've always just really wanted enough money to like pay all my bills and then be able to do like stuff I want on the side. And so
quality of life.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a quality of life thing, and I want to be able to explore what's possible and what I'm capable of.
Yeah.
And do it not late in the morning, so I have to like put off everyone else in my life.
Yeah,
not late in the morning. So you basically want to make
is that
sure
what I said?
Have a chance to sleep in.
No, I don't like sleeping in late at night. Is what I meant to say.
Yeah, quality of life. That's what it sounds like. Yeah. Exactly. So okay, cool, man. I mean, that's a good approach. Nothing wrong with making money. I mean, don't think I'm sitting here vilifying money. Because.
Money's
without
good.
Money, none of this would be possible right now, right?
That dirty money.
Like Diddy dirty money.
Oh, shut.
How do we get that money?
You have to know Sean Combs.
Blue Man.
You get a whole bunch of hot girls to sing for you.
Did you say you have to know Blue Man?
No, I said Blue Meth.
Oh, okay. Blue Meth.
Yeah.
Walter White over here.
Yeah.
I didn't Blue Meth fight the Fantastic Four back in the 60s.
All right. Probably. So are you happy with the gear that you've purchased? Let me ask you that.
Yeah. I haven't been able to test it out as much as I want it to yet.
How come?
But stuff falls through. But really, I just been shooting a lot of B-roll stuff, like essentially. Just,
he has all this equipment, but he bought really shoddy carrying cases for it. So stuff literally falls through.
A lot of stuff I've just been shooting is like, I mean, what you would essentially classify as like B-roll stuff, the audio. So I haven't really tested out my, Rode mic and Zoom H4.
Now you're just making stuff.
So, H4N, yeah. But I will H1N1. Soon coming up
guess
with some stuff.
That, guess who's getting that 6N?
Oh, if that would have been out when I was buying all my stuff. Oh, my goodness.
That's the other thing is the buyer's remorse, because as soon as you buy something, then the new thing comes out.
It's going to be so much more expensive than H4N, though, but it looks freaking
it
awesome.
It is. I'll show it to you when it comes in. What's the advantage, Matthew or Rodrigo, of renting over buying?
If you're project-based, renting might actually be a cheaper alternative. But if you're constantly doing stuff, then you're better off buying it and it pays for itself over the long run.
Out here, I don't think renting's really possible.
It is. There's a lot of places in Denver that'll rent that'll ship overnight.
Ship it out.
Yeah. Lens to go, so if you need a specialty lens, there's some companies that'll ship.
Hey, I have seen some
you a
lens
overnight. And
we've actually for my real world job, we've rented like jibs,
things like
that. So yeah, I mean, there's people around.
Cool.
I like to amass a lot of gear just because I like to tinker with it.
Yeah.
But then the thing is, okay, at 11 o'clock at night, I want to play around with this stuff. I've got access to it, and I can monkey around and just create with it. So, yeah, I think you're probably better off buying, but yeah, you're always going to have that buyer's remorse.
Mm-hmm. It's so cheap now.
It is.
I got my gear relatively, I mean, in the scope of
less than $10,000 for everything that you got.
Oh, God, yeah.
So just in comparison.
It's less than $5,000. It's less than $3,000.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So just for comparison.
You go, boy.
My first setup included a PD-150 from Sony, batteries, tripod, light kit from Lowell, three light kit from Lowell. A Sony UVW microphone. I'm trying to think if I get anything else. Probably some miscellaneous bits.
Mm-hmm.
$10,000 is how much I spent on that.
Yeah.
So yeah, this barrier of entry that we were talking about has dropped dramatically.
Yeah.
But
it's really low.
Yeah. And so people can go out and create. And I encourage people, if you've got the creative spirit, or even if you don't, go out and just put something together. I mean, please, I think we've seen enough shots to the nut up on YouTube that we don't need to see any more of that.
But if you capture on your iPhone, still put it on, because it makes me laugh. And that's fine.
All right. All right. Well, I think you're kind of going and approaching this in a good way, Zach.
Well, good.
But just realize that 5 years from now, everything you just bought, you could probably be able to pick up the same thing or better for $1,000
of the price.
A third of the price.
Everything that you bought in 3 years is probably going to be considered obsolete.
Have you considered that? How often you're going to have to replace your gear?
Yeah. Which is a kind of a reason I went with the 60D. And I've shot on one before. I got mine and I like it and it's nice, but it's not the high end,
right.
Even in the DSLR from Canon range. It's not even close
when
to
it comes
high end.
When it comes to the DSLRs, you want to invest in your lenses and your glass and not the body, because if you invest in the right glass, that'll be interchangeable as the bodies change, and the glass is still the glass. So, Matthew, you had a question for Zach?
Not really a question, but more of something to consider. When I moved to Topeka, in 1998, Topeka was the third largest television market in Kansas, possibly, the top 10 of that Midwestern area, as long as you don't take Texas into account, because, hey, they're not the Midwest. In 1998, I was working with not just digital, but we were still working with Beta. We still had some three-quarter, and they had just phased out the one-inch machines. They were still using one-inch reel-to-reel for certain projects because that was where the footage they needed was. So you want to be able to make sure that if you have, say, 3 years down the line, you've put something together that you may want to consider still using. You want to make sure that you have the archival ability or the ability to access that one way or the other. Because, if you make a wonderful movie and you put it in that metaphorical trunk and you get down the line, you're like, I really want to revisit that piece about the fat guy who works in the comic shop, but we're three formats down the line, or you don't necessarily have a way to access it. You want to make sure you still have some sort of storage facility that, in the digital age, less of an issue, but still something you'll want to continue.
That was the main task I was hired for at my job when I graduated high school, was archiving all of their mini DVs. We had like 400 of them.
When I came to the university, I had a couple of students start the archiving of our 3/4 inch to mini DV. And we still had, and finally I was just like, if people want to take this home and store it at your homes, that's fine. But there is not a 3/4 deck in the city that we can find anywhere to do any more archiving stuff. It's either down or the people are hoarding it because they know that it's the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it's just like, look, we either going to keep this stuff or we're going to get rid of it. And now we've got all these mini DVs and I'm like, good Lord, what are we going to do with all these mini DV tapes? Because there's a historical record here that you want to kind of preserve.
Right.
A lot of it's probably not even worth saving, but you never know. When
we always run into that. We recently went through like a big archive switch from, like, we had, what were they? Those big gray ones.
M2s.
No. Oh yeah, the M2.
We had all these M2s that we then went to our blue violet disc stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which was great because it cut down, like, it's
it's a significant space
size.
Yeah.
But then we're like, do we really need to archive all this stuff?
You know, when you look at a lot of stuff, that's why there's so many missing episodes of Doctor Who, is because people were just like, up, oh, time to clean this out. We're never going to use it again. Throw it in the dumpster. Well,
and the BBC literally had, a process where they'd wipe them and reuse the tapes.
Yeah.
The only reason that Monty Python didn't get wiped was because, I can't remember which creator it was. It may have been Terry Gilliam, was like, we will buy you new tapes. And even then the BBC was like, I don't know if we can just wipe the one. No. We'll buy you new tapes. But yeah, that's one of those things where sometimes they just throw stuff out. When they moved WIBW from the old facility to the new, there were literal chunks of things, like an entire run of the Andy Griffith Show on One Inch Reel to Reel. They just left it because, first of all, it hadn't aged well. But second of all, what are you going to do with it?
Exactly.
You can't archive it. We're not going to keep it. It's all stuff that was just recorded somewhere. And I kind of wonder if there are ghosts in that building watching Andy Griffith. It burned down, but still. Ernest T. Bass.
All right, so this is probably a little bit more on the nerdy tech side for most of our listeners. Hopefully we didn't bore you too much, but technology has really changed.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure we did. That's fine.
No, we totally did.
Yeah, I'm bored and I'm here.
Well, you're always bored, Matthew, so.
Shut up.
But I think it's a good discussion to be thinking about technology and how it's changed and how it's affected how we're able to do things and ultimately what Zach's going to do with the technology.
What are you going
to
do with
Eli? He has at his disposal. Yep. So
all Zach's right. Going to go into a sewer and pile suit on his head.
Let's just finish it up there for this week. Thanks for stopping by and listening to this new episode of Zach on Film. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com where you can find that podcast listing page and give any comments you have on the film technology and how it's progressed over the years and give your thoughts and ideas about that. But while you're there, make sure to click on that Amazon.com link on the front of the page. It'll take you right to Amazon, where you can buy all of your gear needs, from sliders and jibs to cameras and lenses. No extra cost to you, but a little bit will come back to us here at Major Spoilers to keep all this podcast content coming towards you. Next week, we're back to films. We're talking Blade Runner next week on Zach on Film.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.